Sounds True presents The Roots of Buddhist Psychology, a 12-part course recorded live, taught to students of sitting meditation at Spirit Rock Center in Woodacre, California, with author, clinical psychologist, and meditation teacher, Jack Kornfield. And now part one, an introduction to Buddhist psychology and a teaching on grasping with Jack Kornfield.
Buddhist psychology or Buddhist teaching is not a philosophy or a set of beliefs to take on as a kind of protection from the world, nor is it a religion that one should join and kind of do in a ceremonial way. Rather, the Buddha, in teaching many times, said, just as the great oceans have but one taste, the taste of salt, so too all of the true teachings of the Dharma, of the Tao, of the law, have but one taste, and that is the taste of freedom. So the purpose of this particular psychology is very clear. It is to use, to become useful for oneself, to find a sense of inner freedom of the heart. And in that sense, we speak much more about Buddhist practice or understanding, leading to happiness, a genuine happiness, an unshakable happiness, a freedom inwardly. And this kind of happiness that is spoken of or reminded to you is not something that you can grasp or have. It's not a destination, but rather a spirit with which we can travel through life. Now, if we begin to look at our life with some attention or clarity, we need to ask some difficult questions. My teacher Ajahn Chah said that those who undertake a genuine spiritual practice and the sacrifice that it often entails feel like they are swimming upstream in the world, often in the opposite direction of many of the popular values. This is from a peace worker in South Africa who worked for a lot of years in the apartheid system, primarily with Amnesty International. And he wrote, I was 5 or 6 years old, and I was with my mother in a bakery, he recounts. There was this little black child about my age, and he stole a loaf of bread. I remember all the people shouting, thief, thief, and chasing this small child into the street. Two policemen intervened, and I will never forget how they beat this very little child. I remember saying to my mother, please give the child some bread. But my mother was so frightened that she could only take me hurriedly out of the store. This was the moment that I started to understand that this world has a lot of problems. So what are the kinds of problems that Buddhist psychology begins to ask us to face? There's a series of essays that Wendell Berry wrote in a book entitled Sex, Economy, Freedom, and Community, as a poet and a person on the land, in which he speaks about some of the delusions of our culture, the delusions of grandeur. For example, unlimited economic growth, the pet idea that unlimited economic growth can be accomplished within limited space, with limited materials and limited intelligence. Right? That unlimited economic growth implies unlimited consumption, which in turn implies unlimited pride, covetousness, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, and sloth. Only makes the prospect even more unlimited. Right? Or he writes an essay on the food system, grounded in the following principles in our society. Food is important mainly as an article of international trade, one. Two, it doesn't matter what happens to farmers. 3, it doesn't matter what happens to the land. 4, agriculture has nothing to do with the environment. 5, there will always be plenty of food, for if farmers don't grow it, then scientists will invent it. 6, there's no connection between food and health. People are fed by the food industry, etc. A couple more, if you will. He writes a little bit about education, some of the principles of modern education. Educated people are more valuable than other people because education is a value-adding industry. The purpose of education is to make people able to earn more and more money. The place where education is to be used is called your career. Anything that cannot be weighed, measured, counted, or accumulated does not exist. The so-called humanities probably do not exist, but if they do, they are useless. But whether they exist or not, or are useful, they can sometimes be made to support a career anyway. The sign of exceptionally educated people is they speak in a language intelligible only to other people in their field, right? The smartest and most educated people are scientists, for they have already found the solutions to all our problems and will soon find solutions to all the problems resulting from their solutions to all the problems we used to have, right? The main thing is don't let education get in the way of being nice to children. Children are our future. Spend plenty of money on them, but don't stay home with them and get in their way. Don't give them work to do. They're smart and can think up things to do on their own. Don't teach them any of that awful, repressive, old-fashioned morality. Provide plenty of TV, microwave dinners, daycare, computers, computer games, and cars. For all this, they will love and respect us and be glad to grow up and pay our debts. A good school is a big school. Disarm the children before you let them in. So the question that's posed, and it's really a serious one, and it's not new from me sitting up here, we all grapple with it in our own ways, is what brings us happiness? What brings us freedom? What is it that our hearts long for in this life that we've been given? In Buddhist psychology, we are invited to study that question, to study what is unconscious and unwise, the kind of habits and confusion and strategies and conditioning that lead to suffering and pain, loss of flexibility, intolerance, and to discover as well as we study what brings awakening, freedom, happiness. How to do this? As we sit and open with the mindful attention to our life, we can begin to experience in the moments of sitting, kind of practice, we can experience what happens quite directly, the suchness of the world. Here we're sitting not trying to get or do or make or be something, but just to experience and be aware as the waves of experience rise and pass. Now, what is this world that we experience? What is the raw materials of this life? Buddhist psychology begins to have us examine. Our world is made up of 6 things. Sights, sounds, smells, taste, physical perceptions, and then what are called mental perceptions, thoughts and intuitions and feelings, sensing, using the mind as a 6th sense organ. Anybody have anything in their world that's not those 6? Raise your hand, please. I'd like to meet you. Okay. So these are like the palette of colors of experience, the 6 senses that we have. That's our world. With it, there are also 6 kinds of consciousness. Consciousness here means the quality of experience that knows a sense impression. So there's eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose and tongue consciousness, body and mind consciousness. There's a sight and the knowing of it, a sound and the hearing of it, a sensation and the feeling of it, right? A third element in the description of our inner experience from Buddhist psychology, the six senses and the six kinds of consciousness that receive them, in between the sights and sounds and tastes and smells and the consciousness which knows them, there is an array in one system, because Buddha liked to make lots of lists. In one of these systems, there's a list of 52 different, they're called mental factors, or mental qualities which can arise with a sight or sound or smell or taste that determine our relationship to it in every moment. Some of them are called common mental qualities that are always here. Feeling, contact, energy or will, recognition, steadiness. But most of these inner qualities are divided into two sets, called the unwise and the wise, or the skillful and the unskillful. The unskillful ones arise in a moment of seeing or tasting or smelling of some experience. They arise with a small sense of self. There arises grasping or greed. There arises hatred or aversion. There arises delusion. And based on those qualities come attachment, restlessness, duplicity, jealousy, worry, fear, hate, doubt. What it means is that in a moment of experience, when we are caught in the body of fear, in a small sense of ourself, and we react to it, we react by trying to grasp something or trying to push away something that scares us, then out of that comes attachment, jealousy, worry, fear, doubt, and so forth. These are strategies of protection and strategies of clinging and aversion that come under the, in Buddhist psychology, the title of states that lead to unhappiness. It's just what they're called. Now, each of these has an opposite state in the psychology. The root opposites are love, wisdom, openness. So that in the moment of seeing a person or a tree or a sunset or a car or tasting the food in front of you, instead of grasping or delusion, there can be joy, awareness, equanimity, goodwill, compassion, confidence, adaptability of mind, flexibility. These are the other states that can arise with each moment of experience. In meditation or spiritual training, we begin to sense in each moment the experiences that are here and our responses to them very directly. And we are offered, in a sense, a training of those responses to see what is possible in our response to the world. To discover an openness that goes beyond a small sense of ourself. Now, as we pay attention, here we are sitting and breathing, feeling our body and thoughts, or walking, whatever meditation we're doing. In each moment, there's physical perceptions or sights or sound, as I said. And with them, there comes a sense of recognition, kind of memory, this is what it is. And in every moment, there's also a feeling quality. This is one of the common elements. It's there in every moment. It has a feeling tone. That is, every sight or sound or smell or taste or perception will be either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. If you notice carefully what happens in your life, when things are pleasant, you tend to say, "Oh, this is great, let me get more of it." Just notice. When things are unpleasant, you tend to say, "Oh, I hate this." Judge it, or you're afraid of it, and you push it away. When things are neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but kind of neutral, there's often a tendency to ignore it or fall asleep or go into delusion. So the question Buddhist psychology begins to ask us is, how do we respond in each moment to what life presents us? on automatic pilot with habits, fear or grasping, or with a sense of presence, of clarity and wisdom. Unskillfully, greed, hatred, delusion, or with love or openness or wisdom. Now, this isn't meant to be moralistic and say you're supposed to be one way or another, but simply instructions for people to pay attention to their life and look at the patterns or the habits that you have in receiving the experiences of the world. What are your habit patterns? Somebody asked Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche at one point, in Buddhism, where they speak about rebirth from one life to another, but they also say everything is in change, what is it exactly that is reborn? And he said, well, I hate to tell you, but mostly it's your bad habits. So a repeated unwise response, clinging, paranoia, aggression, you know, those kinds of responses, to avoid the pain that is what we share in life. Anybody not have pain? Or to avoid loss. Anyone not have loss? Or insecurity. To try to be happy by grasping certain things that will change, or pushing away others, or ignoring them. If we do it over and over, that habit becomes a kind of identity for us, a false identity, a false sense of self. And Buddhist psychology kind of elaborates on this, as many psychologies do, with different personality types or structures that come out of our history, our habits, our wounds of the past, and the ways that we each seek security, that we each seek somehow to be safe or make it okay. And classically, three personality descriptions, it's more elaborate than this, but I'll give the basics of it. On an unskillful level, are those strategies formed around the reaction to our experience of either grasping or resisting or delusion and denial? Sort of like different personality theories, like the Enneagram has different types you might know, or the Jungian types of thinking and feeling and intuition and sensation. This is looking at our reactions to the world that become habitual and unskillful, unhelpful to us. So the type that is the grasping type is the personality or the strategy formed around a sense of insufficiency, a fear inside that we'll never have enough, out of longing. I'll be happy if I get more and more things, people, pleasure. If only I had that, I would be happy. The if only mind. And then if only I had that, because you know what happens when you get that, then you want the next thing. The wanting mind. Looking for security through a succession of possessions or accumulation. Or to fill ourselves up. So the greed type, it said, enters the room. They describe how they walk and stuff like that. Enters the room and looks around and sees what they want. Their way in the world, what can I get? People who are attractive to them, or, you know, what's hanging, I like that big Tibetan tanka over there. They see what's, I'm a greed type, so it's easy for me to describe this, right? What it is they want, you know, and that's mostly it. The aversion type, whose strategy to be safe, the greed type to be safe, is to get more and more and more and accumulate a lot. The strategy of the aversion is to avoid and push away and condemn and fear and judge, you know, all of that movement. So they come in the room and they look around and they see what's wrong with it. I don't like that. I don't like what they're wearing. It's too hot in here. It's too square. It's, you know, all the things that are wrong, right? The deluded type walks in the room and they don't know what to do. Now, let's see, where should I sit? What am I doing here? Kind of confusion, and so forth. I'll elaborate on these as we go through this series of talks. But this first type, the strategy based on grasping, the description of how they eat is in this monastic text that says they take their bowl of food, and even if people just dump food in it, and they eat genteelly with delicacy, savoring the morsels of food, and they walk lightly and elegantly. There's a kind of dance, you know, where the hateful type walks quickly and shuffles along, and the deluded type drags their feet and bumps into things. And so right. Anyway, these are simply descriptions. You can find them all in one person, as you've noticed already, I'm sure. They're descriptions of what it's like to operate out of the body of fear, out of a sense of contraction. That contraction can be of longing and emptiness that we try to fill up, or can be of aversion to the world, or of not wanting to feel. And each of these in this psychology can be transformed into love, to wisdom, to openness. We'll talk about that more later. But first, let us just stay with how the unskillful responses arise, the unwise ones. So going back to the basic description of life, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, feeling, knowing through the mind, life is a stream of experiences which we have, sense perceptions. And if you pay attention, all you have to do is sit still for a short time, for an hour, you notice that no matter where you bring your attention, it is changing. Thoughts, feelings, sensations, moods, memories. And the more you pay attention as well, you'll notice that that feeling tone I mentioned, one moment will be pleasant, another moment will be unpleasant, then it'll be pleasant again, then neutral, then unpleasant, then neutral, then a period of pleasant, and they alternate. Anyone not seen that? Just does that. The Buddha described it in another language as the worldly winds of gain and loss, praise and blame, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute, the change over and over in our lives. Now, the unskillful strategies are ways that we have been taught or learned to try to be safe. When things are pleasant, we grasp. If I get more and more and more, I'll be safe. When they're unpleasant, oh, if I don't feel the pain, if I can avoid it, resist it some way, I'll be safe. Delusion. If I ignore it, denial, then I'll be all right. There are different ways to try to be happy. But they're not necessarily in harmony with the way things are. They are like Alan Watts' description of the man winding his watch on the way to the gallows. Right? They're a description of somebody who doesn't really look at the world as it is. The Buddhas, all Buddhas, point to another possibility. That this small self that we try to protect and have a history and tell stories about is not our true nature, is not who we really are. And when we rest even for a moment, like a Buddha, in our Buddha nature, there comes in that moment, any moment, a sense of presence and freedom in the midst of all conditions. And that freedom is your birthright, it is who you are, and it has been there from before you were born in this body. If you want freedom, it is here. This is an obituary from the New York Times, kind of an obituary. Dr. Jan Smolowitz died of heart failure in New York last week at the age of 69. He was not famous. He never made the gossip magazines or TV talk shows. And before yesterday's obituary, he'd been mentioned in the Times only once. I guess that's their measure of someone's life. Judging from that obituary, he was, however, a man worth knowing. Dr. Smolowitz was the only member of his family to survive the Holocaust. He survived concentration camps and three death sentences. Nazi guards changed their minds twice because he was a doctor. And the third time, as a medic in the camp, he put his numbered prison uniform on an inmate who had died of typhus. and compatriots said the body was his. The guards were afraid to inspect the corpse. The doctor later escaped and helped liberate other camps. Later, he immigrated to Israel, where he won a medal as an army doctor. And then in 1957, came to the U.S., where he taught, wrote about medicine, and revamped the radiology department of three hospitals. He also helped those further down the medical ladder, encouraging orderlies to become doctors and helping cleaners to become technicians, and founded a program at Harlem Hospital to help local youth become X-ray technicians. Dr. Jan Smolwitz of Southeast Poland, Germany, Israel, and Manhattan lived a life worth noting, not so much because he survived unimaginable horrors, but because he gave meaning and blessing to his survival. So there is a freedom that is possible for each of us. And in Buddhist psychology, we study our experience, what keeps us believing the small sense of self, and what else might be true. So let's take a look further at the first of the unskillful roots of this psychology of grasping, unwise strategy, greed. It's said that if we don't understand this, we are a slave. In the Buddhist text, we are harried or tied by ropes or golden chains by our possessions, life after life. It's said that in any moment, even a bit of grasping, the hair's breadth of grasping, keeps us from the truth. To see the Tao, to see the Dharma, is to see with eyes unclouded by longing. Getting and having. How much does wanting or longing, even for good things, rule our lives, is the question. Grasping, trying to get. Attachment, fear of loss, getting more. Accumulation, things, experiences, money, people, sex, power. It can become our identity. I am what I get, what I have. There's a story of Groucho Marx. He had a woman on his program, Mrs. Walker. She was there because she had a large family. She had 22 children, which was quite a feat in itself. And at some point, Groucho looked at her, you know, raised his eyebrows, and he said, "How did that happen?" And she said, "Well, I love my husband." And he says, "I love my cigar too, but I take it out once in a while." So we're asked to begin to examine or study wanting, grasping, longing, greed. And you can study it in simple ways in your sitting, waiting for the moment, wanting the bell to ring. Know that wanting? And that's a really amazing moment, because you're sitting there and you're a little bit frustrated or restless or bored or something, and you want the bell to ring. And there's that wanting. When will it ring? When will it ring? And finally, rings, right? And what happens in that moment? All of a sudden, you're at peace. The peace that you didn't find in the whole sitting, right, is there. You haven't moved. Nothing has changed except... Now, why is that? Somebody, tell me, why is that? You know? If you look, what makes that moment such a happy one, huh? It's peaceful because at the moment you hear the bell, what stops? The wanting. Oh, God. for a moment. So you get to study what the state of wanting is. You want the pain to go away. You want pleasant thoughts. You want this fantasy. You want this success. It's all the same. But it's not just wanting, you know. I used to think, oh, it's grasping, and I'd read these texts. It's greed. Sometimes, I mean, it's small wanting, but it's greed. And many, many people rape the earth, kill one another, allow people to starve. You know, the Irish potato famine, I was in Ireland this year, so I was reading about it. They exported food to England during the Irish potato famine, some of the rich families, lots of food, shiploads of it. Made a lot of money during that time. Greed. It's not a small force. It's a huge force in the world. Wanting. The description is the hungry ghost in the Buddhist psychology. This being with this huge belly and a tiny pinhole mouth. That no matter how much or how constantly they feed themselves, they can never feel satisfied. Go to Las Vegas if you want to study the hungry ghosts. I'm serious. So it's this. And when we don't understand it, it becomes our identity. Or the identity, in this case, of our whole society. Feeding some unknown hunger. Someone called it feeding the hungry heart. Sogyal Rinpoche, our society is dedicated almost entirely to the celebration of the ego, with all its sad fantasies about success and power. And it celebrates those very forces of greed and ignorance that are destroying the planet. Think about it. So it's been called the addicted society. Remember that passage in this book, Path with Heart? The best adjusted person in our society is not dead and not alive. Just kind of numb, zombie-like. Because if you're dead, you can't work. And if you're really alive, you constantly say no to what's going on in the society. The racism, the polluted environment, the nuclear threat, the arms race, drinking unsafe water, eating carcinogenic foods. Thus, it is in the interest of consumer society to promote those things that take the edge off and keep us busy with our fixes, keep us slightly numbed out and zombie-like. The addicted society. So if we're studying this, it really means to look in ourselves and around. Now, it's not a simple question, okay, therefore you shouldn't desire. Just let go. Mad Magazine, there was a cartoon of Alfred E. Newman with a little dunce cap on, staying after school, writing on the blackboard hundreds of times, cessation of desire, cessation of desire, right? So that's what you should do? I don't think so. Because the addiction and the wanting, if we feel it, and the longing, covers wounds and pain and loss and grief. And to actually be here would mean that we have to open to the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, to the beauty that's all around us and to the immense pain of life that is also around us. So it's not a question of the suppression of desire. Sometimes we may need to have it fulfilled through healing or love or some well-being. But really understanding it and what are its roots in us and what we most deeply want. I remember when I came back from the monastery and got in this first relationship I had with a woman that I knew when I was in college. And so we started to live together. And she'd ask me, where do you want to go for dinner? And I'd say, oh, it doesn't matter. I was really in this place of a lot of equanimity with no preferences, which was what monastic training was about. She'd say, do you want Italian food or Chinese food? I said, whatever you'd like is fine with me, you know. Well, should we go out to the country on our weekend or should we stay home? Oh, it doesn't matter. What would you like? After not many days, it drove her crazy, right? She said, I don't know what you like and what you don't like. I said, well, I'm really easy. I'm open to everything. I don't have many desires. Ha. And then I began to pay attention because she was getting crazier and crazier with it. She gave me an assignment. She said, listen, this is what I want you to do. I want you to get a little spiral notebook and put it in your pocket. And each day I want you to write down 10 things that you like or don't like that you encounter, just to kind of remember who you are, because you were brainwashed. I said, oh, I'm open to everything. I like everything. But then we had our first really difficult fight. It was jealousy and all of this stuff. And she said, I see you want something. What is it that you want? And I looked at it and I realized the only thing, I didn't care where we ate, you know, or where we went in the country. I simply wanted her to love me and to meet all my emotional and sexual and other needs forever and never abandon me. And if that was so, then the rest of my preferences could go out the window, right? Didn't last long, that relationship. So when I talk about studying longing and wanting and grasping, I don't mean just small things. I mean stuff that's at the core of the society and the world and of ourselves. And as we begin to feel inside the hole, the places that we try to fill, when we look at that dimension of our life, or if we do the work of healing or love or finding some kind of well-being, there's a deeper question that comes with it. Even with our painful histories that many of us have, and the things that we need and are frightened of and long for, with all of that, is that going to do it? Whatever it is that who we are? Will some person or relationship or things, getting something, whatever it is, really do it? And what could you get right now that would do it and really satisfy you? So you begin to study in your own body, like a laboratory. If we want to face greed in the world at large, we study it in here. What does wanting feel like physically? Is it a contraction, expansion? What's it like? It's temperature. Is it pleasant? Is the wanting mind pleasant? Is it peaceful? Is it fulfilling? What happens when it disappears? How soon does it come again? What's its tempo? What stories does it tell? Where does it lead us? One teacher I had in India, in Bombay, Nisargadatta Maharaj, put it backwards. He said, the trouble with you is not that you want, that you have all these desires. The trouble with you is that you don't want enough. Why not want it all? You only want a few small things. You could have the whole world. Why not want that? Absolute wholeness and fulfillment. He would sometimes say it another way. He'd say, I don't understand you. You want what you don't have, and you don't want what you have. Crazy. He said, why not want what you have and not want what you don't have? It's so easy. Ah. So first we notice that contraction and all the ways and the places that we hold it and the stories that we tell with it and the history, and ask, is that who we are? And if you pay attention carefully, you can also begin to notice moments as pleasure and neutral and painful and neutral and pleasant and painful and neutral, as the experiences of life which make us up, which we are, as we keep changing and those experiences arise and pass, you begin to notice certain moments where the mind and the heart is not caught by wanting. Moments of silence, or going in the mountains, being in the woods, or sitting with a young child, or just looking at this evening sunset, so beautiful, or an oak tree, just moments of being at ease, having a latte, cappuccino, you know? I have a friend who has cancer and it's metastasized and she knows she's dying. And I'll tell you, it's such an honor to be with this person because she looks at a tree and she just drinks it in and she's so happy to be alive and just to be in the presence of life. And you could say to her, well, what do you want? She'd say, I want to be here. This is really what fulfills me. So you can begin to notice just as you sit or walk or pay attention, those moments that arise when you don't want anything. Who are you when you don't want, when there isn't this longing and wanting? What you start to sense is this kind of mystery. Look for yourself. The mystery in the moment with the oak tree or the sunset. Notice it when you walk down the street. Notice the difference. When you're walking down the street looking for restaurants because you're hungry, or walking down the street looking for clothes stores because you need a new whatever it is to wear. Notice those kind of moments where your activity is tied to what you will get, what you will find. And then notice when you walk down the street and you don't need or want anything in particular, and your heart's just open there, taking each step, noticing who comes by. Just start to sense those different states of being. In Buddhist psychology, it is said that Buddhas rest in awareness, that in each moment of presence, mindfulness, there is a resting in a truth much greater, in a spaciousness much greater than all those stories of what we need, of the wanting. I mean, remember the beauty of it, or sense it, the beauty of meeting people in those moments when you don't want anything. And you just look in their eyes and see them as they are. You don't need them to like you or approve of you or give you or go away or whatever it is you want, you know. Where you just meet that person and what that feels like. A certain ease and receptivity and compassion and clarity that's just there. When we touch this longing, this wanting with our heart, I'm not saying to get rid of it. When we sense that without judgment, and without identifying, just see, oh, there's the longing part, and there's the story it tells, and hold that with compassion, then something greater opens. Its opposite appears. You could call it non-wanting. Lots of other words for it. But in that moment of eyes unclouded by longing, there comes quite naturally to every single being contentment, abundance, compassion, kind of integrity of your being. When I wrote the word integrity tonight, I thought of the visit of Nelson Mandela when he came to Oakland to speak, and kind of the dignity that he carried after 20-some years of prison, the beginning of the change in South Africa, how he wasn't a bitter person, which was just astonishing after all those years. How he simply wanted to speak what was true and beneficial. In the moment when we are unclouded by longing, when we sense this other true nature, wonderful things are present. This is kind of an invitation from the Buddha, openness, generosity. And in those moments, it becomes clear that it's not what you get that makes you happy. And it never was, and it never will be. But who you are, or maybe what you give from that being. And covetousness, jealousy, ambition drop away in those moments. The heart shines. So the force of wanting or grasping, when transformed, becomes creativity, graciousness, beauty. in the Tibetan version of the Buddhist psychology, the Padma type is described as initially grasping passion, the instinct toward union, wanting to be completely one with someone, but it has a hysterical quality, a neurotic quality, which doesn't recognize the true connectedness that is here already. You know, it is concerned with facade, with texture, with glamorous qualities, intoxication. But when it's transformed in that moment of opening, then it becomes a blessing. And there arises instead the beauty of the Dharma. That same sensitivity that's there, and love that we all have, and understanding, becomes informed by our being and not by our needs or longing. And our life moves with the Tao and the service of the Tao. This isn't far away. In a moment, you can feel it. You do anyway, often. So you begin to pay attention to that and appreciate it and taste it and rest in that. And then you see the wanting come and say, is that me? Do I really have to do that again in that way? Or isn't there some other place? J.P. Morgan said, there is a certain Buddhistic calm that comes from having money in the bank. This is a reply from Rumi. A long cry at midnight near the temple. A young man sitting there thinks, what is this life worth? He hears a sound, a drum beat, a celebration. We should start cooking the joy soup. He hears beyond his body of fear to the union, the letting go. He jumps up and shouts to God, if you can be human, come into me now. This is the signal of a death yell. It splits him open, and gold pours down, many kinds from all directions. Gold coins, liquid gold, gold bars, gold cloth. They pile up almost blocking the doors of the temple. The young man works all night carrying the gold away in sacks and burying it, coming back for more. The timid church members sleep through it all. If you think I'm talking about actual gold, you're like those children who pretend that pieces of broken dishes are money, so anytime they see pottery pieces on the ground, they think of money, and you hear the word gold, goody, I'll put it in the bank. This is the other gold that glows in your chest when you love. The enchanted temple is there, and the pointed cry is a candle flame on the altar. The young man is a moth who gambles himself and wins. A true human is not human. Their candle doesn't burn, it illuminates. Some candles burn themselves and one another up. Others taste like a surprise of roses in a room. Are you just a stranger who wandered in? Welcome home, my friend. Welcome home.
This concludes part one of The Roots of Buddhist Psychology. Please turn the tape over for part two.